United States versus Jesus Vargas Montanez et al.
Counsel, take your time setting up. What we're going to do is take you in order. So Mr. Kaczynski will be first on behalf of appellant Vega as amended. My colleague suggested I tell you the whole lineup, and that's what we'll do. Next will be Renee Dowling, then Kai Walker, then Jeannie Espada Ocasio, and then finally Ezart Winter. Okay, so we'll start with. Okay, good point. Yes, that council probably is aware we are holding on to Mr. Manning's argument. We will schedule that at another time, or handle that at another time. So we will hear from the rest of you later today. So, Mr. Kaczynski, whenever you're ready. We will allow you to take to reserve rebuttal time if you'd like, but it's going to have to be a minute or more. So because you can't do anything in 30 seconds. So.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll be reserving 1 minute of.
Okay, that'd be fine. Thank you.
I think we better go into questions since everybody's been to the point. Can we put the blanket adoption issue to the side since we know that under FATA there are no blanket adoptions?
Yes, Your Honor. I was going to address it. Yes. I believe so, Your Honor. Okay. In this issue, well, I would actually.
You can only speak on your client's behalf, I get it, but. So I'm going to probably ask each counsel that, just so that we're clear that adoptions are set aside.
Understood, Your Honor. However, we did. The way that the order was interpreted and the language from the court was that, you know, this was a consolidated brief, and they wanted the parties to join wherever possible to try to reduce the issues on appeal. So that was the.
That, and you're absolutely right. So that if there were a specific adoption, that would work. A blanket adoption without enumeration of what issue one joins is problematic.
Understood, Your Honor. But with respect to the briefing for Mr. Gene Carlos Vega Arizmendia, I want to spend. Well, let's put it as questions on other issues. I want to spend the time and address the issue regarding the admissibility of the translator, the interpreter, Mr. Colley. And the court erred because it failed to address the hearsay issue that arises with a translated statement. And Mr. Giancarlo's post-arrest statement contained essentially two components. There's a component that his original statement, the statement that was made in Spanish, that it was heard by Agent Colley. And then there's the second component, which is the translation of that statement. And the court, the district court in this instance, essentially failed to recognize that second component and address it as one of weight. But you know, while this court has never specifically addressed this issue, other courts apply like a language conduit theory, which looks at whether or not this interpretation is essentially going to be attributable to the defendant. And it's that second component that, again, the court failed to address. And the court relied on, and it misplaced its reliance, though, on the Second Circuit case, United States versus Da Silva. And the language it relied on heavily was if Tropicio, who was the agent, had spoken with Da Silva, who was the defendant, directly, Yekutiev himself testified to De Silva's answers. His testimony as to De Silva's statements would have been non-hearsay. And it's the second part of that paragraph that is really relevant to what the court did not address. It said Yekutiev himself had testified to De Silva's answers, because the testimony at trial wasn't to Giancarlo's answers. It was to the translation of Giancarlo's answers. So it's still that second component that...
But didn't Calmy translate it?
He did, Your Honor, but the cases are not dispositive of who the translator is or who the person was. The issue is the translation itself. So that is where the...
But I thought the argument wasn't as to the accuracy of the translation, which is why it was weight, not admissibility.
I mean, the objection was twofold. The objection was one of personal knowledge by Officer Coleman, because he was a translator. He was not an agent who was investigating the case. And it was also a hearsay objection, citing to that Ninth Circuit case, the Zemian, which is both a Confrontation Clause issue and also a hearsay case. So it was...
Isn't the case a lot different than here, in these circumstances? In that case, it was the case agent that was on the stand, right?
That's factually, it is distinguishable, but I mean, the analysis, again, is important. I think it's important to look at, maybe from a linear perspective, what's going on with Gene's statement and the issues that arise, where the challenge is, because his statement, there's an A to B, which is him speaking in Spanish to Agent Coleman. And then there is a B to C, which is Agent Coleman interpreting that statement from Spanish to English, which is testified at trial. Now, the other cases in the other circuits...
Okay, and the only difference was, instead of Calmy writing his own notes as to what Carlos said, the other agent took the notes, right?
That's correct, because...
Okay, the other agent took the notes.
Because Calmy was the interpreter, that was his...
Okay, but I mean, Calmy could have written down his own notes, but the other agent wrote the notes.
Yes, as the other agent was the one conducting the interview.
Okay, and then before testimony, Calmy looked at the other agent's notes.
Yes.
All right. Isn't that a refreshing of the recollection?
I mean, that goes to the component of personal knowledge. But that does not address really it's really a hearsay issue. This translation is a hearsay issue. Another example, I guess, one in which the same gentleman testifying would be, like, say, for instance, instead of Agent Coleman doesn't speak any English, he's only fluent in Spanish, and he is speaking with Giancarlo, and he uses his phone is like a Google Translator, and then writes everything down in English and testifies in English. In that instance, I mean, there's no translator present, but still I think the analysis that you have to follow in these cases would still apply, because there's still the issue.
That's a better case, right? That's a better case because the Google Translate might not interpret colloquial phrases in the same way. So you'd have the argument, well, we don't know what Google Translate relies on to come to a particular interpretation of a Spanish word into an English word. You don't have that here. As Judge Fisher said, the only thing here was the refreshing of recollection because Calmy testified.
Well, respectfully, Your Honors, we couldn't address those issues at the trial because the judge essentially... I mean, she found those factors to be irrelevant, which is the part of the issue, which is the real error by the court, is that, you know, the court's essentially, when it was raised, this issue pre-trial on motion, it said this issue of the hearsay relating to the translation of the statement is one of weight. So all of that stuff, you do a cross-examination. So, you know, there could have been more fully addressed at the look before the case even gets to a jury, because it's a threshold of admissibility hearsay issue. And another example, I that's maybe more on point to this case is, again, for instance, Agent Colmey was only fluent in Spanish and didn't speak any English. And instead of a Google translator, he uses, I guess, he has a dictionary there, and he spends the entire time translating with the dictionary. And that instance, again, I think the court would still have to take some sort of threshold admissibility issue to say, is this the statement that Agent Colmey is testifying to in English, is that even the same statement that Gene made in Spanish? And that's what those cases address, is the statement that is being said in English same as what was said in Spanish? So the fact that there is a separate interpreter that needs to be there, I don't think is factually relevant to this approach, this language conduit approach that the court should have applied before it addressed that issue. And I see, Your Honors, I've expired my time, so unless there's any further questions.
I think that we'll hear you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear Ms. Dowling for defendant Hodge or appellant Hodge.
Good morning.
Morning.
With regards to Mr. Hodge's argument, I understand the court's position with regards to the blanket adoption. And I would like to say that if, in light of the fact that there's no blanket adoption or that that raises problems, and in light of the fact that we were all ordered to submit our briefs simultaneously, I believe then the appellant should have been given an opportunity once the other co-defendants' briefs had been submitted to then decide whether or not they were joining or whether or not they could add specifics to those arguments with respect to them joining or incorporating those arguments. For this morning, I'd like to argue with regards to Mr. Hodge that what I argued in my brief, that the district court failed to afford Mr. Hodge an impartial trial when it failed to question the remaining members of the jury, when after two jurors had come forward, asked to be excused based upon the fact that they felt that there was a possible threat to them and they were in fear if in fact the defendants were to be found guilty.
Can I ask you a question? Maybe it's elemental, but they did express their issues, but like with respect to juror 12, which I think you mentioned, he was dismissed. How were you prejudiced then?
Juror 12, and just like juror number 5 who came forward before, said basically identical thing. I'm afraid if they were to be found guilty, that there would be retaliation to me, myself, or my family. When juror 5 came forward, you could say, in a sense, okay, that's an incidental affair. However, when juror 12 came forward the following week with the identical fear, the identical expressing the identical concerns, then that, of course, raises a light bulb. It turns on the light bulb. Because obviously...
Well, is it really identical, 5 and 12? I mean, 5 said a relative contacted a mother. Juror 12, indeed, as you said, as you rightly point out, said, hey, I'm afraid.
But juror 5 did say the same thing, that I'm afraid for retaliation. That's what she said.
We have to apply plain error here, right?
Right.
So the plain error applied to this instance would require us to say, absolutely, there should be no question that there should have been an expansive voir dire questioning of everyone. And that's the holding you see. Yeah.
Correct. Well, because once the first juror came by, maybe not, but once the second juror came by with the identical fear and saying fear of retaliation, and we knew that what the previous juror had been contacted, then it was incumbent upon the trial court to then determine from the other jurors whether or not they knew of that contact or whether or not they themselves had been contacted in any form, fashion, or manner. I think that this prejudice...
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
please, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So that I think that the prejudice to the defendant, to Mr. Hodge, is that there was no inquiry made as to whether or not any other juror had been contacted, any other juror had even been privy or to the, or made known the fact of the fear and the threat that the other jurors had suffered. They were all in the same room. And it's not inconceivable that one of the jurors could have said to the other juror, I was, you know, my family was contacted.
What's the prejudice that you were able to put forth, though? Right, I mean, it's, I understand you're arguing logically that's what we should conclude, but there is some requirement that you show prejudice, yeah.
Right, but there was no, there's no record upon which we could find the prejudice, and that's the prejudice to Mr. Hodge in terms of his being afforded a fair trial, that there is no record, that the court did not inquire of the jury panel so that they, a record could be made and defense can argue from it, the appellate can argue from it, from the record, what, whether or not the prejudice existed. The absence of the record is the prejudice, Your Honor. And especially when the defense asked, specifically asked the juror, is there some conclusion? Because it from the juror's comments, it alluded to there being premature jury deliberation. And so the defense asked the juror, is there some conclusion you've come to why you think the fear is more prevalent now than then, meaning at the time they were selected? And the court told the juror, hold up, not to answer the question. So therefore, the record, the absence of the record is a prejudice to my client.
Ms. Dowling, yes. I'm not sure I understood what you said about, at the beginning of your comments about blanket adoption. You said if you weren't able to blanketly adopt the other arguments, you asked for some additional relief. What was that?
Oh, I was saying that then, since we were all ordered to submit our briefs at the same time, we obviously couldn't do specifics with regard to joining in the arguments of our co-appellants specifically. That's why we did the blanket adoption. And I'm saying that in the, since the court consolidated the matters and required us to submit our brief simultaneously, then time should have been allotted or afforded to the appellants to then determine what specifics with regards to the other arguments that the co-appellants made that we can adopt.
Well, was there any application made for extra time?
No application was made for extra time.
I mean, what else would you like to argue that you haven't been able to argue? Well, what else is there that you want to argue before us?
With regards to my appeal?
Yes.
You're not talking about the other appellant's arguments?
I'm talking about your arguments.
Okay.
I mean, you've written other things in the brief, which is before us.
Correct.
And that's all before us, and we will consider that.
Correct.
Okay.
So what you're saying is that anything that I didn't get to argue because their briefs came in at the same time that mine came in, I can argue it now? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not in charge of the panel, okay. But do you feel that there's something more you would like to say in a written form? If there was no blanket adoption?
Yes.
All right, well, we heard your argument. Brad, we'll consider what you said. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We'll hear now from Kai Walker for Quinones Aviv.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May I please support? My name is Key Walker, and I will be arguing on behalf of defendant Sergio Quinones.
Sorry, mispronounced your name.
That's okay, the way it's spelled suggests that it would be pronounced Kai. Now, I would like to reserve 2.5 minutes of rebuttal.
Okay, that'll be granted.
Thank you. Your Honors, unless there's any specific questions, I'll just jump into my argument. The first argument that I made was with regards to a variance in count one as it relates to the conspiracy charge. The substance of that argument, Your Honor, is that there was evidence, a wealth of evidence put forth during trial that made clear that defendants Hodge and defendants Quinones Davila had no agreement to work together. In fact, not only did they have no agreement to work together, they made clear, and it was made clear through cross-examination of the main informant, Schoenbaum, and also cross-examination of AJ Gaumond, that they refused to work together, that they made statements to the informants that they refused to work together, that at least one of those two...
Withdrawal from the conspiracy?
I'm sorry?
Is your argument... I think your argument is that there are... That if anything, there are two separate conspiracies.
Correct.
Right? So, to the extent that the government disagrees, right, based on the actual predicate that it argues, that would mean that your client would have to have withdrawn from what you described as conspiracy number one, and he was, you know, not part of this. He might have been something else, but not part of this. As I think about the facts, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, while he addresses or expresses some antipathy and refusal, right, he continues to act in a way that does not show that. Like, for instance, if I said, I don't like you, I don't want to work with you, and, you know, I separate myself and don't do anything, you know, I don't deal with your law practice or whatever, just as an example, then that would be a withdrawal, would make the argument stronger. That's not what happened here, as I understand it. You'll correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I would argue that there was a withdrawal. There was a withdrawal from the conspiracy to the extent that the conspiracy involved defendant Hodge. And not only did Quinones Davila make it clear that he did not want to work with defendant Hodge, if I were to use your analogy, he said, not only am I not going to work with your law practice, I'm going to steal your clients. So there was testimony in the record through Schoenbaum that Quinones Davila even suggested, I don't recall actually specifically if it was Hodge or Quinones Davila, one was even plotting to steal from the other. So Quinones Davila, when he made it clear that he no longer wanted to work with Hodge, because admittedly they had worked together in the very beginning of the conspiracy in at least one or two of the earlier alleged overt acts, once there was a fallout between the two, it was made clear to the informants that they refused to work together. And the reason that that fact is important is because the only connection between those two defendants turned out to be the informants who they could not have conspired with because they were informants. And when you look at the my statement of facts, and when you look at the evidence that came through, that came forth through the testimony, it was the informants that continued to try and connect defendant Hodge with defendant Quinones Davila by trying to use the same people, by trying to introduce them to the same shipments of cocaine. But defendant Quinones Davila made it clear that he would have no dealings with Hodge, so there could not have possibly been an agreement between the both of them.
But there was an involvement of the two of them at the beginning of the alleged, well, no longer alleged, I guess, the conspiracy, right?
There was dealings between them with regards to a specific act. To the extent that the conspiracy or the acts continued with defendant Hodge, then defendant Quinones Davila arguably would have withdrawn from that.
Right, but we know that if a person, if it's a 12-month conspiracy and the person engages in activity in, say, month one, right, and the conspiracy continues until month 12, you still are guilty of a conspiracy charge from month one to month 12, even though you only acted, engaged in an overt act in month one.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that there is not a conspiracy then between those two after the first act, or I would also argue that then Quinones Dávila would have withdrawn from the conspiracy because the conspiracy continued to involve defendant Hodge. There were statements made to Schoenbaum that Schoenbaum testified to, particularly on cross-examination, that made clear that Quinones Dávila was doing his own thing, separate and apart from anything that was going on with Hodge. The only thing that Hodge and Quinones Dávila did was continue to communicate and work with Schoenbaum. The only connection between the two were efforts from Schoenbaum under the direction of the agents to obtain evidence and to encourage these two to work together. I even included in my statement of facts excerpts from the discovery with regards to the second informant that the government did not call as a witness, Nisbet, where Nisbet is encouraging my client to work with Schoenbaum, encouraging my client to somehow may have some connection to Hodge. But to the extent that there was even a conspiracy that lasted for 12 overt acts, that was a conspiracy that was really engineered by the government through its informants. And that's the crux of my first argument. I think my time may have run out, I don't know.
It is, I had a question though. I was wondering about your, a little bit confused by it, but your acceptance of responsibility reduction. You spent a lot of ink in your brief talking about the government reneging on a cooperation deal and all that, but is there anything in the record showing that your client actually accepted responsibility? I understand, assuming all that is true about your relations with the government, at any time did your client actually accept responsibility?
The evidence of acceptance of responsibility would be the testimony of the agents who questioned him. And it would be specifically the agents who testified as to the information he provided, who testified to the screenshots that he shared with them that was in his phone. So if Your Honor is asking as far as I'm accepting—
That's cooperation, isn't it?
It is cooperation. Unfortunately, because of the context of the circumstances, and if I may just jump into that very briefly, the arrangement that my client had with the government at the time that he was arrested and he engaged in the proffer sessions and counsel was provided to him to engage in those proffer sessions was for him to cooperate. And there were two reasons that he would be cooperating according to this agreement or discussions he had with the government. One, that when he was extradited to St. Croix, that he would be released so he could continue cooperating.
I understand all that. And your brief is, you know, speaks to that very clearly. My question is just how do you accept responsibility as separate and apart from cooperation?
He accepted responsibility when he was cooperating and when he was engaged in the proffer sessions. He could not, at this point, because the government had reneged on its deal, there was no platform for him to accept responsibility in the typical way, to say, well, then I plead guilty, because they had reneged. So he was not receiving the benefit of the information that he had provided. And not only did he not receive the benefit of the information he provided, that information was then used against him to convict him in trial. So the government benefited twice, actually, from this. The only possible resolution or the only possible remedy to the government reneging on its agreement would be the reduction in his sentence, because he did provide the information, you use the information, and when you obtain a guilty verdict against Quinones Dávila, you obtain a guilty verdict against all the other defendants.
Was there a letter for either transaction or use? He just proffered without having signed anything? There were no, because it makes this so. The government took the information, there was no there was no understanding as to what was permissible with regard to the government's use of it?
There was an understanding that I spelled out through the colloquy that was given at the detention hearing when his counsel at the time was questioned. And that understanding, as testified to by his counsel, Ms. Reyes, was that when you get to St. Croix, we'll release you so you can cooperate, and then you will also receive the benefit of a reduced sentence. So you would receive a benefit at sentencing for providing this information and cooperating. And we also have to remember that when he provided the information, he also cooperated at the same time because he started texting suppliers. And when the suppliers would respond, he would share that information with the agents. So not only did he provide information, he cooperated and he received absolutely no benefit from that and was convicted as a result. The reason I say he was convicted as a result is because the first trial resulted in a mistrial and the government didn't even disclose the screenshots that it had from his phone. One of the other major issues with this case was the government's discovery disclosures. That was not a part of the first trial at all, which ended in a mistrial. His statements were not used against him until the second trial. And the evidence that they had and the screenshots from his phone were not provided until the eve of the second trial, or actually during the second trial. I'll have to check my notes. So the government definitely benefited from his information and his cooperation, turned around and used it against him, and he received absolutely no benefit. The only benefit he could have received would have been the reduction of his sentence.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from you on that. Next, we'll hear from Jeannie Espada-Picasio for Appellant Gutierrez-Calderon.
Good morning.
Morning.
Attorney Jenny Maria Espada, on behalf of Mr. Gutierrez-Calderon, I may please the court. I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
That would be great.
Your Honor, we will start with the extension, the overflow extension of the courtroom. We are convinced that in this case, the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial, which extends to the jury selection, was violated with this alternative that the court chose. It is clear law, and I can cite Presley versus Georgia, that trial courts are obligated to secure the attendance of relatives, loved ones, and even the press during every phase of a criminal trial.
Can that be a basis for vacating a conviction?
Yes, Your Honor. It should be a basis.
And do you have a case on that?
Well, I can cite, I don't have the exact citation, but Candelario versus United States from the First Circuit. It was a death penalty case in which the court closed the courtroom in that case there was actually, because court case law states that there may be circumstances in which the closure or limiting access of the public may be warranted and requested. But this was not such a case. In the case of Presley v. Georgia, there was an ambiguous fear that because it was a small courtroom, the relatives could be near the jury panel and they could overhear anything that was said. That was his case. In this case, it was simply a reason of comfort, for lack of a better word. It's a small courtroom, so they wanted to have all the panel together, and they opted for the most onerous alternative, which is to exclude the relatives and place them in the overflow room, so-called, so that they could see it from the closed circuit TV. Now, there was an evidentiary hearing mainly promoted by Mr. Gutierrez Calderon's pro se motion and then supported by a supplementary motion filed by his trial counsel. In that hearing, even the witnesses, Arroyo and Messier, who were court officers, stated that at least Arroyo said that on one occasion, she passed by the overflow and the closed circuit TV wasn't working. So if that, that completely rebuts the fact that it was a public trial in the sense that the relatives were not allowed to come into the courtroom and the facilities that were allegedly prepared were not functional, and no previous notification was provided to counsel that this alternative was the one chosen by the court. When case law such as, I'm sorry to be repeating the same case, Presley versus Georgia states that other alternatives can be explored, such as, for example, dividing the panel, or perhaps they could have put half of the panel in the overflow room and allowed for at least one bench for the relatives. So this is an egregious violation of Mr. Gutierrez-Calderon's Sixth Amendment right, Your Honor.
It is- Could I ask you a kind of threshold question? I believe that you argued that the motion regarding this matter, it was untimely, but that should be excused because your client told prior counsel about the whole issue.
That is correct.
Do you know where in the record that is? I tried to run down where, you know, is there any evidence of that? And if so, where is that in the record?
Well, Your Honor, that is one of the problematic issues was that prior counsel did not put Mr. Calderon Gutierrez in the stand to testify to that effect. So in that sense, the record is void of that fact. But nevertheless, it was raised, albeit untimely. And still, we believe that that would not really cure the violation of the Sixth Amendment right. We made some further arguments regarding, Your Honor, the enhancements, specifically that Mr. Gutierrez Calderon deserved a 3-point increase because he was a supervisor, manager, or leader. The record truly, Your Honor, where he was present in Miriam's bar socializing and that he sent some money that was never really corroborated that his intent was to send it to further the drug trafficking endeavor. So in that sense, Your Honor, we believe that even taken in the most favorable light for the government, those enhancements would not and should not proceed. Are there any questions?
I think not. Thank you, counsel. We'll get you on the move. Thank you. All right, next would be Mr. Winter for Appellant Vega Arizmendi.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
Everybody. If I forget something, my memory is good, but I was diagnosed with COVID now, and this is coming better than it was 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And if I have to look or anything like that, bear with me because
of course
I'm working in that. Okay. Now, I know you all have read the brief. I like the, there's a certain part that I observed that I put Mr. MR twice, and I sincerely apologize, and maybe I was giving him too much respect. My concern, as a former police officer, I know Sean Baum. I know the Sean Baum family. And the father was a well-respected person in the police department when I was there. The children did not turn out that way. Mr. Schaumbaum, who was a police officer, was terminated from the police department. He was arrested, and after he was arrested, he then started working as an informant with the federal government. I submit to you that he was facing so much time that he came and sat right there and he lied and he made all types of misrepresentation. And in reference to my client, What is most important is that if you look at the entire record, it does not show that my client was identified until coming to the end of the trial when the government was wrapping up.
Well, I mean, in fairness, counsel, I mean, the jury had the opportunity to consider the testimony, the photographs, even the tattoos identifying, and they still rejected it.
No, but you see what happened, you have to look at how the tattoo, for the first time with the tattoo coming to the end of the trial, when he went and said he's identifying the tattoo. Now, our position is that the tattoo that he identified, he first said he did not know my client that way. But the father came and also testified that his son tattoo was not at the location that Mr. Shambam said. Okay? Now, what is most sad about this case is that a year later, I find out that one of the jurors' son were good friends and in cahoot with some of the illegal things that Mr. Shambam did. It's, of course, of no consequence. In this case, it wasn't proven a damn thing. But what I am saying, at all point in time, Mr. Shambam was not a credible witness, and he lied, and we tried to prove that he lied because he was getting such a benefit from the federal government. And that is the long and the short. And he testified to anything that they wanted to get or to hear, okay? And that tattoo, the father, I brought him from Puerto Rico, and the father, looking at the video, said that that is not the tattoo of his son. He said that he had a tattoo. But if you look at the entire transcript in all the cases, Mr. Shambam and my client, Mr. Arizmendi, did not have any interaction. My client did not have any interaction with any of the other people. And my position...
Are you saying your client wasn't on any of the trips?
I am saying that there were times that he was on the boat. But I am not saying that he ever went to South America with them. And there's no evidence in the record that shows that. There is no evidence that shows that he picked up any drugs. None. And I submit that I rely strongly, I think I reviewed my brief several times since starting last week up until last night and this morning to make sure there's nothing that I need to add. What concerns me most, and...
Was your client on job number two or no?
I didn't hear that.
I said, was your client on job number two or no?
On job with me?
The second run, if you will. The second job.
If he was with me?
Oh, no. I said, was he on the boat for the second run?
I cannot answer that. I don't think so, but I am, as an officer of the court, I would not swear to that, because as far as my client has indicated to me, and he spoke Spanish, I speak English and a little bit of Spanish, I did not understand that he ever went. There's no evidence of that in the record, and there were times that the testimony came out that they were together, but they were together on the island. And nothing wrong with that. What concerns me most is that one of the jurors and son and Mr. Schaumbaum were very good friends. The next thing concerned me most is that he got a hell of a deal. And I am not a criminal. I hope never to be a criminal. But I think if I put myself in the shoe of a criminal and I was in his place, I would have done exactly what he did, and I would have lied and do everything possible not to go to jail. I think that that is what Mr. Sharma did, and he brought perjured testimony against my client. And the record will clearly show that he's not tying my client to all the other stuff them that I have heard. And the only thing that they are looking at is they're saying he is in a boat. The picture of the boat is in the harbor here, not even outside of the water jurisdiction, the 3 mile zone.
What about the testimony that your client was on the Scorpion during multiple attempts to retrieve cocaine? What about that testimony?
My client, he did not take the stand and deny it, but my client told me that it wasn't true, but that didn't come.
There was testimony to that effect, though, right?
Yes, there was testimony to that effect from Schaumbaum, and I am saying that you should never believe Schaumbaum. You have to know Schaumbaum. Schaumbaum family, the Aho police officer, they were terminated from the department because of illegal activities. I was a police officer, I know. And I know that he knew how to work the system. Schaumbaum knew that if he cooperated with the FBI and he tell them what they need to hear, he will walk. And that's what he did. He walked. And that is my concern. That is my concern. Because we didn't believe him when we were police officer in the Virgin Islands Police Department. And I do not believe when the police them arrested him. And I think that the FBI agent wanted someone like him to work for him, and he worked and he lied and did everything he had. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even honest to show that he and his sibling had had problems over drug fight.
Well, thank you, counsel. I think we understand your argument. And your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I speak in addressing you all?
Thank you.
Have a good rest of the day in the Virgin Islands.
Thank you. Thank you. Now we'll hear from the government now.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Adam Sleeper on behalf of the United States. Unless the court has specific questions or issues that they want me to address, I'm going to lead with the issues that have been raised by my friends.
What about the last question? Why don't we start with the last question?
That's the sufficiency of the evidence regarding Anibal Vega Arizmendi.
Yeah.
Your Honor, a consistent theme in these motions for judgment of acquittal is a lack of trust for Timothy Schaumbaum. The bottom line is that the jury heard his testimony, considered his testimony, credited his testimony. This is not the venue for relitigating the credibility issues that were raised at trial. Touching on the specific instances that Anibal Vega Arizmendi was involved in, I put together a chart of who was involved at different times. What I have is him. Anibal Vega Arizmendi was involved on the second and third trip in October 2014, the third trip of which was successful in retrieving 71 kilograms of cocaine. He was also participated in the first and second trip in December 2014. And I also see him participating in several trips on November 2015.
So there was far more testimony in the record as to his involvement than just the picture.
Correct, Your Honor. And not only is there testimony about him being on the vessels going out, there's testimony on him being on the vessels going out before and after there was a successful retrieval of cocaine. you know, belying any sort of allegation that he may not have known what they were intending to do when they were going out on this vessel. Turning to the tattoo issue and all of that, the jury was able to see the tattoos. Obviously, those tattoos and what he showed on that day are not in the record at this time, but the jurors were able to consider that. They've seen the pictures, they saw the tattoos, and they still convicted. There's certainly no basis in the record for this court to determine that that, you know, for whatever reason, was so suspect that it would be warrant a judgment of acquittal. Shifting to the acceptance of responsibility question that is defendant Sergio Quinones Davila. As a preliminary matter, I note that I don't believe it's been resolved as to whether or not there was any sort of cooperation agreement, or if there was a cooperation agreement, what exactly its terms were. There was some
I had asked counsel about sort of perhaps disconnect between acceptance of responsibility and cooperation. Is that something that you would agree with? What's your comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's a different question, and I think it's a different remedy. You know, if the defendant says that he's giving statements based on he was somehow misled about a cooperation agreement, or we did not act in accordance with the cooperation agreement, the remedy there is to seek some sort of suppression of those statements or something along those lines. That doesn't turn into some equitable acceptance of responsibility. Acceptance of responsibility, if defendant Quinones Davila wanted to accept responsibility, he very well could have. All he had to do was plead guilty to the charges. And frankly, then at sentencing, he could have brought up all of this other stuff as well and argued that they were factors that could be considered at sentencing. None of this has to do with whether he accepted responsibility. The things we're looking to when he's accepting responsibility is, is he going to trial on this? Is he contesting his factual innocence or contesting his factual guilt? And that's very much what he did here. I don't think there's anything in this record that would show that or come close to showing that the district court clearly erred in determining that he had not accepted responsibility.
Well, I thought the argument was that he had been misled. And I wonder, I asked a question about whether there was some sort of community letter given at the time of proffer. In the absence, I presume there's nothing.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
In the absence of is there anything precluding the government from using information that may have been related in that process?
At the risk of making arguments for my co-counsel, you know, I think maybe you could try to make some sort of argument about involuntariness based on false promises or things like that. Maybe that's the context. But again, none of this would go to acceptance of responsibility. It would go to should we be suppressing these statements, which was not an issue that was presented or litigated, and is entirely separate and apart from the acceptance of responsibility issue. Moving on to the variance issue that's also raised by defendant Quinones Davila, there is certainly sufficient evidence in this record for a reasonable jury to determine that this was one conspiracy rather than two. We have the evidence of Hodge. I think the real meat of this argument is that Hodge and Quinones Davila are separate. I don't know that the defendant has really split out who's in which conspiracy, but I think certainly the takeaway allegation is that there's at least one conspiracy with Hodge and one with Quinones Davila, and I don't know where, I'm not entirely sure where the other people are in this setup. But Hodge and Quinones Davila, there's clear evidence of them working together in August 2014, October 2014, November 2014. Then once you get to the November 2015, there's Hodge meeting Schoenebaum with the other conspirators, and Schoenebaum and Quinones Davila speaking later that week, and Quinones Davila saying that he'd surprised Schoenebaum. Now, I know that the defendant argues that Schoenebaum is not reliable, but again, we run into the same issues that we have the same issues with the argument raised by Annabelle Vega-Arizmendi, and that's that the jury was able to make contrary credibility determinations regarding Schoenbaum's testimony.
Is there anything to the withdrawal argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what this shows is that there was an ongoing conspiracy. There was certainly some friction between the two members of the conspiracy, Quinone, Stabla, and Hodge, but I don't think there's anything in the record that would require a determination, or sorry, that would prevent a jury from determining that there was just one continuing conspiracy here. I'd also note that once we get to November 2015, both Quinone Stabla and Hodge were ensuring that Schoenbaum was paid for gas. I believe in my brief I said 2014. I'll file a notice for out of there just because that's an important date to get right. And also that there Hodge introduced Schoenbaum to Danny Boy, who was first mentioned in that 2015 issue. And then after the November 14, 2015 arrest, Quinone Stabla asked where Danny was. So what this all shows is that these people are still working together. This is one conspiracy. Certainly the jury was entitled to make that finding, and there's no basis for granting a judgment of acquittal on count one for that reason. Turning to the Peter Kalme issue, court's indulgence. Peter Kalme had personal knowledge because he was there. He was the one translating the statements. His ability to understand and translate those statements also were not at issue. The district court said, I believe it was in the footnote, you know, if there was some sort of, or it might have been a footnote in our brief, but at least the district court addressed it and said, you know, if there's some sort of due process issue here about whether Peter Kalme can translate Spanish, you know, he clearly knows Spanish, he translates on, you know, regularly, there's no basis for an objection there. So really the sole question is, does Peter Kalme have no knowledge of the conversation that he himself translated? And was he solely testifying from these notes?
Indeed, your adversary pointed out there's a hearsay problem here.
Well, there would be if he was just solely testifying from their notes, but that's not what the record plays out. The record plays out that he said he recalled the conversation, and certainly nothing stops the government or anyone else from refreshing his recollection with notes from someone else.
There's no evidence that the notes were placed in front of him and he testified from the notes. Is there?
No, I didn't see anything that would indicate that to me in the record, Your Honor. And so under these circumstances, we think that United States v. Nazemian is clearly inapplicable. We're not dealing with the question of whether or not Peter Kalme was testifying as an agent of the defendant or not. Rather, the hearsay exception that was at issue was admission of a party opponent, and Peter Kalme being present there at the time and hearing and understanding the original statement from the defendant was perfectly qualified to testify to that. Turning to the issue raised by Jose Hodge, and that is the question of
the jurors,
yes. What distinguishes this case from all of the cases that are being cited by defendant Hodge is that there's just no indication that any of these jurors spoke to each other about any of this.
Well, I think your adversary, your friends across the aisle would say, well, we don't have that because the judge didn't give us a chance for a hearing or do anything, really. How do you respond to that?
Well, and just to clarify, Your Honor, that's why I'm saying it was not plain error to not hold the hearing, because there was no indication that there was this type of conversation, right? So in the cases where cited by the defendant, where they're talking about, oh, the court really needed to be holding a hearing, that's because there was testimony that, for example, a juror was threatened or something was said to them, and then they told the other jurors about it. Here, there's just no comparable statement being made. Juror 5 said she told no one about it. Juror 12 said he told no one about it. I know the defendant speaks about defendant 12 during their So defendant 12, there was a first conversation on one day, then a second conversation after he was sent out, and then he was dismissed on a second day. I know defense counsel in, or the defendant in his brief references that juror number 12 was set out from that first meeting without any instruction not to speak to the jurors. But it's not in the record where he went. It's possible he may have gone and spoken to the jurors. But two, on the second day when he was excused, he specifically told the judge that he had not spoken to anyone about this. So there's no indication in the record that either juror 5 or juror 12 communicated any of these issues to the other jurors. In the absence of that, it's certainly not plain error to not question.
Why is it appropriate for the district court to question juror number 12 ex parte on the second occasion?
Your Honor, I would agree. I don't think that was the best way to go about it. But again, we're in plain error. And I don't think that we have, you know, to the extent that that wasn't the best way to approach it, I don't think we have anything that would justify relief under plain error review. I'd also note that this issue is raised by Defendant Hodge. Defendant Hodge, on the first day, took the position that juror 12 should have been excused. So the only thing that came of the second meeting was, in fact, juror 12 being excused. So it's difficult to see how there was any prejudice for Defendant Hodge when he got the relief that he'd been actually seeking out of that hearing. Turning to the issues discussed by Defendant Omeo Gutierrez Calderon, to speak a bit about the closed courtroom, this is not, because we are on plain error review and defendant agrees, this is just not, to the extent there is an error, and the case law in our circuit as to exactly how overflow rooms work and all of that is a bit unsettled, and there were some technical issues here. So I don't think the court needs to resolve those issues here. I think probably the better way to resolve this is through the argument that the government raised in its brief, and that's that even if there was an error, this error would not have seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings.
In the first instance, isn't there an untimeliness issue?
There is, Your Honor. There is. And the district court found that it was untimely, and that determination has not been challenged on appeal. And so any argument that it was timely has been waived at this point. Just to touch on the merits, where the district court considered the issue of the apparently large number of jurors and provided an overflow room shows that they were considering alternative to excluding the public entirely and were really trying to make it available to the public. The judge was not informed that anyone believed that they were excluded. It was only 5 months or 5 days of a 2-month trial. And because there was a large veneer, 131 people, there were significant members of the public that did not end up in the jury observing it. And there was no suggestion of misconduct during voir dire. And turning to the other side, the cost of the new trial, this would be redoing a 2-month trial. I think at this point we're 4 2/3 years after the fact, after the second trial. And so just weighing these against each other under Williams, this is not the type of error, if it were an error, that would warrant granting any relief on that issue. If the court has any questions about any other issues, I'm happy to discuss them.
Your brief covered a great deal. I think we have nothing more for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we'll hear a rebuttal from the defendants who reserve, from the appellants who reserve.
Thank you.
honors, the government said in its response just now that there's no hearsay problem because the statement made by Gene Carlos was a hearty admission. That statement in itself sort of applies the lingua contra theory, because Gene Carlos's statement, his party admission, was made in Spanish. The only way you can somehow attribute an English version of that statement is by applying some sort of conduit theory or by applying the Ninth Circuit holding, and that's what the court didn't do in this case. The court simply stopped at simply saying a Spanish statement is a party admission, but we don't have to get to that English translation. And that's the error, and that's what that's the hearsay problem that is inherent in this type of situation. And so I contend, Your Honor, it isn't correct to simply say that there is no hearsay problem there. So with that, unless there's further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Reserve
time.
Ms. Walker and Ms. Espada, Casey.
Okay. Ms. Walker, do you have anything more you'd like to add?
Yes, Your Honor. With regards to the acceptance of responsibility issue and Your Honor's questions with regards to acceptance of responsibility versus cooperation, I believe counsel for the government argued that there was no necessarily basis that would preclude the government from using those statements in the absence of some sort of written agreement or something to that effect. And I would argue that there would actually be a common law basis for the preclusion of that because there was a breach of an agreement. The argument that that issue should have been resolved by way of a motion to suppress. The statements by Mr. Quinones Dávila were produced on March 14, 2018. Trial was April 2018. In addition to those statements being produced, there was other evidence that was still being produced. The statements that were produced in the forms of screenshots and there were some CDs that contained audio were in Spanish. So those also had to be translated. And one of the things that I did prior to trial was request a motion. I filed a motion for continuance because of the untimely disclosures, which was denied in part and granted in part to the extent that I think the judge allowed for an additional 2 weeks. And it's what the record does not capture is the tone of the trial. The fact that there was just so much withheld evidence that was continuously being disclosed on the eve of trial and the mornings when we would walk into the courtroom, we would find new evidence on our desk. Now, with regards to those statements that were used in the second trial and not in the first trial, one of the arguments that was made by the prosecutor at the time, Attorney Andrews, when I raised the issue regarding the agreement was, it doesn't matter, we're not using it anyway. On the eve of the second trial, then there's a dump of the phones, there's a dump with all the screenshots, the text, and the statements. Now, the argument that Mr. Quinones Dávila did not accept responsibility does not, because he did not enter a guilty plea, logistically doesn't make sense. There was no plea offered that would have given him the benefit of the cooperation and the earlier acceptance.
It's not a unique situation. Defendants make proffers, prosecutors reject them, you know, they made it on a good faith basis. Counsel sometimes makes it that information, or at least that offer, available to the sentencing court. What is it that you mentioned an agreement as well? What agreement are you referring to?
The agreement that he would have been released when he was transported to St. Croix so he could continue to cooperate and he would get a benefit for it at sentencing. He didn't get a benefit for it at sentencing, which is the basis of my argument. And I rely on the comments to the sentencing guidelines, which made clear that even in the absence of a plea agreement, if a defendant goes to trial, the fact that he goes to trial does not foreclose him from receiving the benefit of accepting responsibility. The comment makes clear that a conviction doesn't necessarily mean that he does not get that benefit because he could have went to trial for other reasons. When you review the transcript of the second trial, you will notice that there was not a claim by Mr. Quinones-Dabla that he was not engaged in drug trafficking. Mr. Quinones-Dabla's arguments were, I wasn't in a conspiracy with Hodge. Mr. Quinones-Dabla's arguments were, you know, I was not involved in these last overt acts because I had withdrawn. I had told them that I was not working with Hodge. The only way he could preserve those arguments is if he went to trial, which is what he did. But at the end of the day, those statements that he made in the cooperation he provided after his arrest were used against him in the breach of an agreement. And the only relief that he could have received would have been a sentencing.
Would it be fair to say that your client continued to contest his factual guilt at every stage of the proceeding?
He continued to contest his factual guilt to the way that he was charged, and to the extent that he was charged in a conspiracy with Hodge. But at the end of the day, there should be no benefit to the government to use statements when they breached the agreement with him. And then one of the other arguments that I wanted to address, I believe, dealt with the count one conspiracy charge, which I believe the argument was made that Quinones-Dabla inevitably continued to work with Hodge. And work with Hodge in one of the later overt acts when gentlemen had traveled to St. Croix, Schoenbaum had picked them up, he had brought them to the area of a grocery store. When you look at the record and you look at the testimony of Schoenbaum, those were two separate incidents. There was not an agreement for Hodge and Quinones-Dabla to work together in that later overt act. In fact, what was happening was that Hodge was trying to steal the shipment from Quinones-Dabla. So there was no agreement and there was no conspiracy. And then finally, I was not asked about the blanket incorporation. And I understand Your Honor's statements with regards to not being able to incorporate the arguments of other counsel. To the extent that Your Honors are considering
it. Well, we talked about blanket. Per our opinion in the Fatah case.
I understand that, but to the extent that we're still making a record on appeal today, if I were to identify specific arguments to incorporate, it would be that of defendant Hodge with regards to the jury issue, and it would also be that of defendant Gutierrez Calderon with regards to the exclusion of the family members from the courtroom.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we'll finally hear from Ms. Espada Ocasio.
Thank you. During my previous intervention, the court specifically asked whether there was any type of case law.
Excuse me for one second. Do we reset our time? Okay, that's okay. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
I lost my way.
Oh, sorry.
No, just kidding. The panel asked us whether we had any specific case in which a new trial was granted. And we said Candelario case, it's Candelario Santana, 834, Federal 3rd, 8, 2016. In this case, de facto closing happened of the courtroom because one of the witnesses feared for his life. This is a massacre death penalty case in Puerto Rico with a lot of press. The judge opted to make it like a false closing of the case and resumed the works of the court outside of the public to safeguard the witnesses' reluctance and fear. Now, we put forth, Your Honor, that in this case, it's pretty similar. A de facto closing happened. First of all, the defendant's family members attempted to enter and they were excluded. They were consistently told that they could not be there. They were moved to a room where none of the officers could really safeguard the fact that the CCTV was functional and they were actually viewing. And we put forth, Your Honor, that does lacerate the trust and the integrity of the judicial system. our judicial system is wonderful because it's transparent, it's public, because judges, witnesses, and defendants and all the parties involved in a trial are subject to scrutiny from the public. But the moment at any phase that the public is excluded, then that should warrant a new trial, Your Honor, more so than considerations like expense and inconvenience and the length of the trial. We put forth that this type of violation is so egregious that only a new trial can be the only remedy for this type of Sixth Amendment violation, Your Honor.
Your time's up, counsel, but if you had one other quick point, we could.
No, that's okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate it. We thank all counsel for their excellent both written and oral argument today. And we'll take the case under advisement and ask the clerk to adjourn court for the day.
Please rise.